The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anushka Astana. If you thought things were calming down for the summer, you'd be wrong. After a chilly G20, the Prime Minister relaunches herself. Well, actually, she just said this.
So I say to the other parties in the House of Commons, read this report, engage with the difficult issues it raises, come forward with your own views and ideas about how we can tackle these challenges as a country.
Promise of cross-party working, eh? The problem is that Jeremy Corbyn just isn't biting.
If the Prime Minister would like it, I'm very happy to furnish her with a copy of our election manifesto. Yeah. Or better still, an early election in order that the people of this country can decide.
Yeah. And soon the parties were rowing again over the Great Repeal Bill, the first piece of Brexit legislation, and over the publication of a review by former aide to Tony Blair, Matthew Taylor, into the changing world of work. Much focus was inevitably on the so-called gig economy. We'll hear from a Deliveroo worker experiencing it all at the sharp end. And in a week in which Parliament also elected women to lead the Treasury and Business Select Committees, and when Labour and the Tories clashed over questions of abuse during the election campaign, we'll also hear from Harriet Harman, Parliament's longest-serving woman. Joining me for all of this, I'm delighted to welcome Bonnie Soanes, executive producer of Women's Parliamentary Radio, and the first journalist to ever highlight zero-hour contracts back in the 1990s. The Guardian's Rob Booth, who's been leading the way in reporting of the gig economy, and Sonia Soda, The Observer's chief leader writer. Rob, what are the main findings of the Matthew Taylor report?
Oh, well, he's tried to get into the whole question of flexible workforce and the way that we're changing our world of work. And one of the big things he wants to do is to try and improve the quality of work for people at the minimum wage. He's worried about a kind of productivity squeeze, that there's, you know, millions of people, more and more people actually, at the wage floor, and that's going to have a consequence for people's ambitions and the inability of people to get on and have pay increases and therefore their productivity. So he's worried about the quality of work at that level, but he's also had a go at trying to cut through the complexity of the gig economy and the new world of work that's being enabled a lot by technology, and trying to work out a way in which the rights and responsibilities can be rebalanced between these kind of mega billion-dollar companies and some of the kind of more vulnerable workers in our society. And he's tried to cut through that with a limited kind of success, I think.
And you say limited. I mean, he's talked about this idea of a dependent contractor, Sonia, someone who might have more rights around holiday and sick pay, but no new regulations. Is that good enough?
I think the Taylor Review is a really mixed bag. So when he talks about dependent contractors, he's essentially relabeling a status that already exists in the law, which is called a worker status. He has given them some new rights, for example, to sick pay, but I'm really worried about this idea that workers, what he's now calling dependent contractors, might not be entitled to the minimum wage. I also think that there was too much of an emphasis in the report about nudges for employers. Now, I think that's a bit naive, because I think the idea that employers who exploit, some of them are just doing it out of sort of, they're just not quite clear that what they're doing is wrong, is absolutely wrong. There are employers out there who seek to make a profit by exploiting workers, by doing things like not paying workers the minimum wage that they're owed, and nudges are not going to solve that problem.
So, Bonnie, they're not going to do it out of the good of their heart, and you've been watching this change over many years.
Over my journalistic career, I was one of the first journalists as a BBC local government correspondent in the Eastern Region, covering 9 counties, including the new towns, which were built with terrific values to people: houses, gardens, allotments, upstairs, bathrooms, downstairs, toilets. And people had jobs. And when they lost their jobs, because in the 90s, local government went through compulsive competitive tendering, the dinner ladies lost their jobs, the people who emptied the bins lost their jobs. And in Northamptonshire, it lives with me and sits on my shoulder today to still report that. When the Northamptonshire dinner ladies were put onto zero-hour contracts, there were suicides. Now, I would go a step further. I don't think the Taylor report is naive. I think it's culpable. I agree with Labour's Rebecca Long-Bailey. If it looks like a job and smells like a job, it is a job. If Matthew Taylor has ever had to compete in the gig economy, which I've done as a self-employed freelance journalist for 22 years, the complexities of the process which he's suggesting that dependent contractors have to go through to become a employee in some way will in turn give employers, all employers, an administrative process by which they can discriminate. They can say, well, we've got enough dependent contractors at the moment, we don't need any more, so we're going to get rid of you. People get rid of you after 4 years when you've been employed on contracts because you then get employment rights. I mean, what land is Matthew Taylor living in?
Well, you talk about Rebecca Long-Bailey, and one of the things she said was actually that she would like to boycott Uber, which, of course,
Absolutely.
Caused a bit of a stir. Now, another company that we hear a lot about is Deliveroo, and we've actually spoken to 24-year-old Mohan Biswas, who mainly works for Deliveroo. Let's just hear what he has to say.
When it started, they wanted to be like the luxury brand. It was more narrow in the restaurants that you could collect food from. Now it's a lot wider. The riders are like, we provide our own bikes and our own everything we pay for. So now you can work anytime you want. But like, the reality is you have to do the evening shifts to make enough money to survive. It's one of those things where it's all right. It's great as a job until things go wrong, because there's no interaction with Deliveroo as management or as a company. Like, we all literally, once you're signed up, that's kind of it. Unless you need equipment or anything else, there's no support. As soon as something goes wrong, if I've had an accident, I've had a bike stolen, people are dependent. This is people's income. This is people's lives. Like, as soon as that stops because of something that you can't control, your entire life suffers as a result. That basic level of protection that most people get from employment just isn't there. I think the Taylor route kind of needs to get taken with a pinch of salt, because he might be, from what I've read, it appears that holiday pay and sick pay might be in his recommendations, but he seems to be saying that these companies can get away without paying people minimum wage during non-peak periods. So I don't know whether this is a step forwards or a step backwards.
Rob, how typical is that?
Well, I think that is typical of lots of workers, not just in working for Uber and Deliveroo, but also for, you know, Hermes and the courier companies that work in this sector. I mean, I think there are things that Taylor is trying to persuade the government to change, actually, which would improve some of the insecurity that he was talking about there. So if you're shown to be under control or supervision, which many of these workers are, and I think will be if the law was changed, you would then get sick pay and holiday pay, which is, and the argument that Taylor has made is that the average worker working averagely hard should get at least 1.2 times minimum wage. So as a result of that, there's a potential for people to get better standards. But the thing that still isn't there is any removal of the insecurity. They can still lose their jobs at a moment's notice, and that's a big thing for lots of these kinds of workers.
Sonia? And I think the other thing is, we just shouldn't be allowing workers not to get the minimum wage. I don't see how different it is from a factory saying, for example, you know, we might have periods where we've got really low demand, but hey, workers, you can come in and work for us. We'll be totally upfront with you that you're not getting the minimum wage. It's your choice. How is that different from what Matthew Taylor said about giving Uber and Deliveroo the flexibility not to pay workers a minimum wage? And Bonnie, I noticed that The Times was arguing that while many people are hit badly by things like zero-hour contracts, they were claiming, although I didn't actually see any evidence of this, that more people enjoy the flexibility.
Well, Matthew Taylor quotes 62% of the people he asked, but, you know, what planet, who did he ask? Most people want jobs, and most people want to know what kind of hours they're going to work and what kind of income they're going to have. 2 years after New Labour came in, I was a part-time worker. We got rights we never had up until that New Labour government came into power, including as part-time workers, men and women. We could join pension funds. We couldn't join pension funds. So you can be a part-time worker. You don't need to be in the gig economy. But researchers at the Centre for Business Research in Cambridge have surveyed over 117 countries over 43 years. And they prove that actually, if you give workers rights, productivity increases. And we've got a huge productivity problem in this country. Has Matthew Taylor looked at that research? Because it takes into account the developing economies. And even China is giving workers more rights.
Just give us a quick final on this positive in favour of Matthew Taylor here, Rob, because I feel like you're the most positive round the table. Do you think his intentions are in the right place?
Well, I think that he's trying to do something that is very difficult, actually, which is to try and deal with the new way that these apps enable people to work and still try and give them the rights that they've been denied, wrongly denied. I think that it's almost impossible to do that if you still continue to want the absolute freedom that the app providers want to give. And I think that he perhaps should have gone a bit further in trying to persuade the government to be firmer on it. But I guess the political situation that he's looking at meant that he perhaps didn't feel that was possible.
Well, we were able to put all of this to the man himself, Matthew Taylor, chief executive of the RSA, who was commissioned by the government to do the report. So, Matthew, we're all interested in the changing world of work. Can you just kind of summarise how technologies in particular were affecting people's lives as you saw it?
Well, I think there's a kind of short-term and a long-term issue. You know, the long-term issue is that technology, robotics, machine learning, sometimes called AI, is going to have a big impact. We're doing a lot of work on that here at the RSA. I think that some of the more exaggerated claims for how many jobs are going to go are not soundly based. I think it's more going to be about how tasks change. And in relation to the review, we emphasize the importance of two things. One is that industrial strategy should be about low-pay, low-skilled sectors and not just about the kind of high-end export sector, which is what it is tended to focus on more. And secondly, that when we think about technology and innovation, we need to think more than we do at the moment about the interaction between technology and human beings. Sometimes when we talk about innovation, it's too much just about the technology and not enough about the human interaction, because actually that's where productivity comes from. In the more immediate term, we have the issue of gig working and the way in which platforms can disintermediate and break jobs down into tasks or gigs. And of course, we had a set of recommendations about how it was we responded to that, protected workers, ensured that people are paying the right tax, but didn't lose one of the great strengths of that way of working, which is the freedom it gives people to work whenever they want to work.
And are you convinced that it is more of a positive for people than it is a negative?
Yes, and I think that since the review has been published, you know, this is kind of one of the big debates, but it's a slightly kind of wearing debate because, you know, in as much as there is research, it's pretty consistent that you know, between about two-thirds, three-quarters of people who work in these new ways, and also some other ways, casual ways that have been going on for much longer, like zero-hours contracts, about two-thirds say, no, this is actually how I want to work at the moment, it suits me, and about a third to a quarter say, I don't want to work like this. But usually, even for them, it's not so much they're complaining about the way they're working, it's just they would like a different type of job. And that's one of the reasons I've resisted, on the one hand, for example, banning zero hours, on the other hand, or recommending banning zero hours, on the other hand, acting in relation to those gig platforms in ways which would force them to, instead of allowing workers to work whenever they want to, having shifts. So we thought very hard about a particular way in which we could protect workers, but let those platforms offer what they're offering. And I think it's a solution that works, although it's clearly one that people are finding quite hard to fully understand.
And one of the ideas, obviously, is to give them a new status. But don't they already kind of have a particular type of status?
Yeah, so I, you know, perhaps it's a bit early to be admitting mistakes. But I think one thing that we were not sufficiently clear about in the review was this issue of dependent contractor status. So I think what we were trying to get at was this. The way that it works is that there are two categories that we kind of know about, the self-employed at one end and employees who get all the rights, including unfair dismissal at the other end. In the middle, there's this catch-all category called workers, and workers get most rights, including minimum wage, holiday pay, sick pay, but they don't get the full set of rights, like, for example, the right to claim unfair dismissal that employees get. Now, actually, we thought that it was worth looking at how we describe that those people, because they include agency workers, and actually agency workers are subject to particular rules. They've got their own inspectorate. It includes 0 hours work, but it also includes this new gig work. So when we talked about dependent contractor status, we weren't really talking about a different status, because this would be a group of people who got worker rights, and it would almost certainly be a group of people whose employers would have to pay national insurance. But we were saying, do we need to think about how we can better distinguish between different types of people in this worker category?
Okay. One of the things that we noted, admittedly ahead of when the review actually came out, partly on what was briefed to us in advance as journalists, was there was a bit of an emphasis on the idea of no new regulations, partly from you, partly from the Prime Minister. And also you talked about the employment wedge. Can you just tell me, because, you know, the instinct to that is to say, well, without regulations, isn't it hard to actually get change?
Yeah, that's a great point. And it goes back to this point I've just made about these three categories. So I would argue that the protections that we give to full employees are pretty good. You know, I mean, obviously, in a perfect world, we would do more, but you know, we have got, obviously, the minimum wage. We've now got auto-enrollment in pensions. We've got right to request flexible work. I think that what we do there is not bad. And what we mean by the employment wedge is the costs, the extra costs associated with employing somebody over and above their kind of basic wage. The problem is structurally that because of that wedge, it encourages people to casualize their workforce because workers get fewer rights, and it further encourages people to find ways of defining workers as self-employed because they get even less rights. So what we've focused on is, where do you draw that line between self-employment and worker status? And the broad implication of what we're saying is that quite a lot of people who are currently described as self-employed would probably be workers, should be defined as workers, and should get workers' rights. And secondly, a whole set of interventions to protect that middle category, that worker category, which includes 0 hours workers and various other casual workers, agency workers. And that's where we focused our energies, rather than on the kind of top end, those people who are full employees who currently get the full set of protections.
Okay. And just a couple of very quick last things. We were talking to Bonnie Soanes from Women's Parliamentary Radio, who you may know, who was reporting on things like zero-hour contracts back in the 90s. Yeah. And she was talking about dinner ladies back in the 90s being moved onto essentially these less secure contracts, and actually some of them ending up being suicidal as a result of it. And she was absolutely convinced that, you know, this is not something that is in the benefit of workers who essentially want jobs. What would your response be to that?
I would say, look, I freely admit that I'm more of a nudger than a shover. That is to say, my view is that the best way to tackle problems is often through a series of small, thoughtful interventions rather than trying to wave a big stick. I am resistant to the idea of trying to abolish forms of work, categories of work, where most of the people who do it say that that is how they choose to work. But there are very important things that we do that will shift the balance. So first of all, we argue that people on variable hours should get a higher minimum wage for the hours that are not guaranteed to them. And that is part of a bigger debate about how it is we ensure that the principle of overtime, if you're not guaranteed work and people ask you to work over and above what you're guaranteed, you should be paid more. And that's an important principle which we establish, and we ask for specific action in relation to those on minimum wage. But there are other things that we do. So, for example, don't underestimate the impact of our proposal that every worker and employee is told on day one of their rights and entitlements in plain English and any deductions they'd get. Because we heard that a huge number, for example, of casual workers do not know they're entitled to holiday pay. Right. And often they don't take that holiday pay. And so, you know, if you work for 3 weeks or you work for 3 hours a week, the fact that you have got holiday pay might be something which doesn't, you know, you're not aware of, it doesn't seem relevant to you. And what we're saying is this, What you must be told on day one is that if you want to, you can take that holiday pay in a rolled up form. What that means is you could say, I don't want to build up holiday pay entitlement. I simply want to take this as a 12.07% increase in my salary, which I'm taking in lieu of holiday pay. So if you we did look really hard at these issues and really hard at the kinds of interventions that would really make a difference without trying to stop people doing things that they choose to do. And I'm absolutely sure that if all our recommendations or the vast majority of recommendations are put into practice, it would represent the biggest shift in the way in which we regulate work and the biggest shift in power towards the people I'm most worried about, which is that group in the middle, that worker group that we've seen for a generation.
Now, Bonnie, we have heard interviews from Theresa May to mark one year, one very difficult year as Prime Minister. I've just been away to the G20 with her and we were all searching for her human side. And I was quite struck when a broadcaster asked her whether she was misunderstood when people said she was robotic, to which she replied, I think what's important is that we get on with the job, and getting on with the job is about delivering for people. I mean, it couldn't have been more robotic. Is that just who she is?
It appears to be who she is, and she appears to not be able to let go of that reserve, which clearly she has, and shyness, which she has admitted to actually communicate on a level which is meaningful. But I have to say this, I've known Theresa May for a long time now. She formed Women to Win, which was a brave move back in the 90s.
To try and get more women into the Conservative Party.
Parliament. Yeah. And when we celebrated 90 years of women in the vote in Lancaster House with Harriet Harman, Vera Beard, all the Labour women, she was the only Conservative woman to walk into the room. Now, that took guts. So she clearly has guts, and we all know there's a really strong alliance of women in Westminster across party, including Maria Miller, who again is chairing the Equalities Select Committee, and that chairmanship went unopposed. It was supported by Labour's Yvette Cooper. But yes, I think she has to let go. She basically has to change personality to convince people that she really does understand what the lives of the people she professes to want to help are really like, because she is heading a nasty party, a party that she called out many years ago for being nasty.
But behind the scenes, have you seen that more human side?
Yes, I have, because if I'm in a room, Theresa May, and I'm in a room with basically a lot of male lobby and press correspondents, Theresa May will cross the room and say, hello, Bonnie. Now, she remembers my name, and she will cross the room to talk to
me. Did David Cameron ever do that?
David Cameron once showed me all the women portraits in Number 10. Of course, there haven't been many women prime ministers. So apart from Margaret Thatcher, they got portraits of people's wives and daughters. But at least they had tried in Number 10 to have more portraits of women. So yes, he was very courteous.
Now, the government has released its Great Repeal Bill, the kind of biggest piece of EU legislation that we have seen. The Lib Dems say they're going to make life hell for the government. And in an exclusive interview with our very own Heather Stewart, Labour's Keir Starmer says Theresa May could face defeat if she fails to make significant concessions. Sonia, is Brexit actually going to happen?
I think we have to wait and see. The way, if it weren't going to happen, the way I think it wouldn't happen is not that we're going to see some sort of massive parliamentary opposition that kind of derails the process altogether. I think what might end up happening is that it becomes very apparent we're not going to get a good transitional deal within 2 years. We extend the talks. We have a transitional deal that lasts 4 or 5 years. Maybe public opinion changes. So I think that would be the way that it doesn't happen. I think Labour are playing this incredibly smartly, actually, because they are not sort of getting boxed into coming up with their own really proactive position. They are politically saying, though, there is this Great Repeal Bill and we are going to amend away on the stuff that really matters to us, like workers' rights. So they're not opposing Brexit, but they are using this bill to make sure that what they care about as a party gets tacked onto it. And I think that's very politically smart.
Well, those workers' rights are something that I spoke to Harriet Harman about earlier. She is now called the mother of the house because she's the longest serving female MP. And I started by asking about the EU and how worried she is about the Great Repeal Bill.
Well, I am worried because what the government are saying is that they're going to guarantee that no rights that women currently have are going to be undermined by us leaving the EU. But what has happened over the years is that women's rights have improved because of us being part of the EU. So issues of greater rights for parents, issues of strengthening equal pay and the ability to challenge unequal pay, they've been a sort of evolving process in the EU. And what we don't want to do is to get off that escalator of progression and then be frozen in time and not have the advantages that women in the rest of Europe are going to get. We don't want women in this country to be Europe's poor relations when it comes to their rights of work, as rights at work evolve in the rest of Europe and we get left behind, stuck where we are now. And what I think that the government should put in the Great Repeal Bill, not just you will have the rights that you've got at the moment as a woman in the workplace, but actually you will keep up with the rights of other women in Europe. It's a moving situation. We don't want to be stuck here whilst everybody else moves ahead.
Okay, and here in Parliament, we've got over 200 women MPs for the first time, a breakthrough. Still just 32%, so not quite time to pop the champagne corks?
Oh, absolutely not, because although we are a critical mass and our voice counts because we are a critical mass, we're no longer a tiny minority, but we still are outnumbered by men. And it is also the case that because women MPs last less long than men, they've got less years of experience and therefore less years of seniority. So there are fewer women, we're outnumbered by men, and mostly they're newer.
And you've carried out the research that shows women serve less long. I mean, why do you think it is?
The research that my office did with the House of Commons showed that women MPs last 30% less long than male MPs do, which is quite a substantial amount. Some people might assume it's just because it's very difficult to combine being an MP, especially for an out of London constituency, with having, you know, family responsibilities, or that it's difficult because there's a lot of abuse of being a woman MP. But actually, what the facts show is that it's because women tend to only get to be more likely to be selected in seats which are less safe. They're more likely to be selected in marginal seats, and those are then seats which change hands when the political climate changes, and therefore they then fall out of Parliament.
Okay, and this week I pointed out that there were only 23% of candidates for those powerful select committee chairs who were women. You thought that we should have been telling a more positive story. Tell me what it was.
Because select committee chairs and select committees are very important indeed, and the chairs are very powerful because they don't owe their position to the government or to the whips. They've actually got complete autonomy because they've been elected by members of the House of Commons. And select committees are even more important now because Parliament is strong because the government is so weak and faltering. But select committee chairs are usually members of the House of Commons who have been around a considerable length of time. And because women are outnumbered by men, but also because women have served fewer years than men, women are less likely to be able to be able to grasp these select committee chairs. And that's why it's such good news that amongst the new crop of select committee chairs, we've got Sarah Wollaston on health, we've got Yvette Cooper in home affairs, we've got Meg Hillier in public accounts committee. For the first time ever, we've got a woman chairing the Treasury Committee, which is Nikki Morgan. There's never been a woman chancellor, but now we've got a woman chairing the Treasury Committee. We've got a woman chairing the Transport Committee. We've got a woman, Rachel Reeves, chairing the Business Committee. So we've got women in very powerful positions in these Commons committees at a time when these Commons committees are of ever-growing importance.
Now, on a more negative note, both sides blaming each other at the moment over this question of abuse of candidates in the election. I mean, I've personally been shocked by what Diane Abbott went through in this election and previously. Sarah Wollaston, a Conservative, has talked about a masked man graffitiing her office and pointed out that, you know, Tories are described as scum, which wouldn't happen to other groups. What's going on?
Well, I think that undeniably there is a problem, and it's particularly focused on women and particularly focused on younger women, or in the case of Diane Abbott, a black woman, of abuse and harassment and threats. So I think that that is an absolute fact that that is happening. The second thing is that this is clearly something that we need to be doing everything we can to stop, because this is undermining democracy. What is important is people to have the choice of their own representative, and then their representative to be able to get on and represent them free from intimidation and harassment. So this sort of thing is an attack on democracy, and we must take it with absolute seriousness. Now, there is two ways of dealing with it. One is to deal with it within a party, like, for example, to have very strong rules, which I think we should have in the Labour Party, strong rules that say that you get expelled from the Labour Party if you engage in misogynist abuse against women representatives of the Labour Party. But I think we should go further than that and recognise this is not just a problem within political parties. This is a problem across the political parties, and all of us should be concerned, not just if women in our own party are under threat of abuse, but also women in any party, because a misogynist attack on one woman is a misogynist attack on all women. And we've got to, in a spirit of solidarity and a commitment to democracy, let alone the sisterliness of feminism, we must all stand together against this. And as Labour women, we've got to be as vocal in protesting and demanding action to protect Conservative women MPs or candidates as we are with our demands to protect our own Labour MPs and candidates.
And just finally, we've heard a slightly more human side of Theresa May today, talking about being devastated by the exit poll, crying on election night, or at least there was a tear. Now, she does get criticised for being a little robotic. Do you think that she's treated differently as a female PM? And do you think it was the right thing to do to be a little more revealing in that interview?
Well, I think Theresa May's, the issues and the problems of Theresa May are less about whether she's perceived to be robotically unfeeling or whether she's seen to be crying her eyes out. The real problem is that the economy and our public services under her prime ministership are in grave peril. And therefore, I think that those are the main issues. And what I'm concerned about in relation to Theresa May is that with her as Prime Minister, loads of children's centres are closing. With her as Prime Minister, people working as teachers and nurses have seen their pay fall behind inflation. So I think there's a lot of discussion about this, but ultimately we've got to focus on what is the absolute fundamentals, which is with her as Prime Minister, there's a lot of people working in the public services who are crying their eyes out, and a lot of people who are needing public services who are crying their eyes out, and a lot of people who are feeling very worried indeed about whether they're going to have a job in the future, because whether or not under Theresa May, the economy is going off a cliff.
Fantastic. Harriet, thank you very, very much.
OK, back with my panel. Bonnie, as exec producer of Women's Parliamentary Radio, you have seen it all. Is this a golden age for women in politics?
I think it is. We've now got 208 women across party in Westminster. That's the highest ever, over 30%. We've got stuck on 29%. 119 Labour women. And they're already working across party to inflict defeats on the government. We've seen Diana Johnson's infected blood scandal, Stella Creasy on the Northern Ireland abortion. So they're already making a difference. And the next defeat could well be on the WASPI, the women's pension issues, and the deferment of those pensions twice by legislation in 95 and again in 2011. So they are an organised group, but they're not just organised within their party, and that organisation gives them an energy. They're organised across party. They team up with people like Heidi Allen, even Nicky Morgan. They know who they can get on side to inflict defeats on the government. And I think the WASPI issue will be the next defeat that the Labour women inflict.
One that I know you have been campaigning passionately upon. But Sonia, I know this is not just a female thing, but what is going on when we see these levels of abuse against MPs?
Yeah, well, for anyone who watched the debate yesterday that MPs had about the levels of abuse in the election, I mean, we're talking really shocking stuff happening to MPs on both sides of the aisle, and it is particularly bad for women, for black and minority ethnic MPs, for LGBTQ MPs as well. And, you know, this is really damaging to our democracy, I think, because if you look at the abuse that MPs have to take, it's something that really stalled us.
It's not just the MPs, it's their families.
Yeah.
And that's what gets them so enraged, because in a way they can accept that there's going to be this confrontational, aggressive atmosphere. But I was struck yesterday, I listened to the debate, by how many were saying across party, that including Lisa Cameron of the SNP, a clinical psychologist, she's worked in other professions, but how different the 2017 election was to the 2015.
Yes, it's definitely got worse if you speak to MPs who've been around for a time. And I think the question is, what do we do about this going forwards? And I think we need a really cross-party approach. I think that we need more action from the police. I think social media platforms need to take more responsibility for shutting some of this horrific abuse down. But something's got to change, otherwise it's going to be really bad for our democracy in the long run.
And Rob, watching this as someone who's outside political reporting, but clearly you know quite a lot about it, one of the things that struck me is, you know, you've got a story in the Daily Mail accusing the hard left of terrible abuse. You've got the Labour Party accusing the Tories of unacceptable abuse. Presumably, this has to be something we all work on together.
Well, it's not just political, is it? This is something to do with the tone of our kind of expression online. It's to do with the kind of wider acceptance of bullying that seems to go on, and it's just getting worse, you know, all over the place, not just in the House of Commons. And you see it in playgrounds, in schools, even at work. You get it when you're tuning into Facebook and Twitter particularly, and there needs to be some kind of way of pushing back harder against this anonymous bullying that goes on. A lot of it is hiding behind the anonymity of avatars online. And I agree. I think that the companies that run these systems must do much more to try and push back against those people who are using these hiding places.
And the political parties too. I don't think it's just enough for one political party to say, well, it's the other side that have got it worse. I think we all have to take responsibility for this. I think we have to recognise that abuse exists on all sides, very ugly abuse. And so the question is, what are you going to do about it on your own side? And I would like to see both political parties taking more action.
And Heidi Allen was moved to tears by the testimony of Diane Abbott, who, when she heard the Conservative MPs complaining and others, she just said, "Welcome to my world."
And I should say that every time we've written a lot about Diane Abbott and she's exposed a lot in The Guardian, and every time we do it, we receive a huge amount of abuse. And sometimes someone's just got to call all of that out. Now, clearly abuse is something that might put women, for example, off coming into Parliament.
Absolutely.
Now, Bonnie, I know you were cheering the 32%, but I was mentioning to Harriet earlier that 32% still not good enough. And aside from the abuse, there is another issue here, and it's about how family-friendly Parliament can be. I saw Ellie Reeves, a new MP for Lewisham, the other day, taking a toddler through the voting lobbies. Hurrah, that is real progress. And she's also got an on-site nursery that he goes to. But she pointed out that with these late night votes, she will still not see her child at bedtime for at least 3 days a week, and in fact more if she's then in two parts of the country. What can be done to make Parliament more family friendly?
I think we have to move towards electronic voting, something Margaret Hodge and others suggested when we wrote our first book. I mean, that was back in 2005. And it was contentious then to suggest that you had job share MPs or we have online voting. But I think a lot depends not just on your MP, but where your constituency is and where you live. And, you know, there was feelings back in 97 that certain Labour ministers were being let off the whip because they lived in London and wanted to go home to a dinner party. Well, clearly, you couldn't do that if you lived in Manchester or Liverpool. So I think there should be online voting, and there's no reason why we shouldn't have it.
Do you agree, Sonia?
Yeah, I think we've got job share political editors of The Guardian. Why can't we have job share MPs? Absolutely agree.
And Rob, one thing to say, we talk about this as a kind of women's thing, but actually increasingly there are young male MPs who have a totally different attitude to fatherhood and to family life than their predecessors. I mean, this is about men's rights too.
I think one of the things we get concerned about with politics is the lack of kind of experience as well. And I think if people can't stay in politics for long time, you know, build careers, become ministers and move around and build up that depth of experience. And that's a big problem for our kind of governance. And that a lot of that has got to be to do now in this modern day with, you know, allowing people to be the parents that they want to be as well. So I think you're dead right. I think the idea of job share MPs is brilliant, actually. I think that's really good.
It was Margaret Hodge who first suggested it, and the whips didn't like that.
Well, I think...
I bet they didn't.
I just think that the load that MPs have to bear of casework, which is the bulk of what I see them doing, you know, when I'm kind of interacting with them, is so great that I think two people looking after that and two perspectives on those sorts of... The huge range of issues that they have to deal with from their constituents would be wonderful.
And I'm very optimistic that Joe Swinson will, you know, produce alongside people like Caroline Lucas, who's written about this. They'll produce change, I think.
Well, I am evangelical about job shares, although clearly I have a vested interest. That is all we have time for this week. Thanks to Rob Booth, Sonia Soda and Bonnie Soans, and also to Mohan Biswas, Matthew Taylor and Harriet Harman. The producer was Rowan Slaney. I'm Anushka Astana. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.